right, all right, all right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today, we're going to be taking a trip. It's going to be really interesting. The whole show is going to constitute a big trip, okay? At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with two of the actors from a new play that I saw just recently called What Kind of God? It's a play that explores the chasm between belief and trust in the Catholic Church, among other things. Before that, we'll be talking with Sikivu Hutchinson, author of Godless Americana, Race and Religious Rebels, a collection of essays that challenge the myths behind the Americana images of mom, apple pie, white picket fences, and racially segregated, God-fearing Main Street USA, all right? I am afraid of God-fearing Main Street USA. Anyway, but opening the show up, I'm really excited about this because I've been really excited about this since it first was pushed in front of my face. Just a little while ago, I think it was August 25th or something, somewhere around there, Voyager 1, the spacecraft, left the solar system and it went off into the interstellar space. And I'll just give you a hint of, I wanted to read something before we get started on this because I thought it kind of put it into perspective in a certain sense. And it was something that was written a long time ago. It's from Carl Sagan in Cosmos. It says, the solar wind trickles into the outer solar system far beyond the orbit of Saturn. When Voyager reaches Uranus and the orbits of Neptune and Pluto, if the instruments are still functioning, they will almost certainly sense its presence, the wind between the worlds, the top of the sun's atmosphere blown outward toward the realm of the stars. Some two or three times further from the sun than Pluto is, the pressure of the interstellar protons and electrons becomes greater than the minuscule pressure they're exerted by the solar wind. That place, called the heliopause, is one definition of the outer boundary of the empire of the sun. But the Voyager spacecraft will plunge on, penetrating the heliopause sometime in the middle of the 21st century, skimming through the ocean of space, never to enter another solar system, destined to wander through eternity far from the stellar islands and to complete its first circumnavigation of the massive center of the Milky Way a few hundred million years from now. We have embarked on epic voyages. All right, that's Carl Sagan. It sounds epic voyage to me. And here to talk with us about all that is Suzanne Dodd, Voyager Project Manager. Suzanne, how are you?
I'm very good. Thank you.
Sure. Well, welcome to the show. I'm looking forward to talking with you here. So let's jump into this. Right away, people get a sense of sort of the enormity of this Voyager 1 and what's happened with it. But your team has actually talked about how this has reached interstellar space and it's considered one of the most important milestones in human history. Why is that?
Well, Voyager 1 is the furthest out spacecraft. It's the furthest man-made object from us. And a year ago, we traced it back to August 25th, 2012, Voyager 1 crossed into interstellar space. Now, I want to be clear that we're not saying that we are out of the solar system, because the solar system also includes the Oort cloud, which is the location where comets basically come from and circle around the sun. So we're not saying that we're out of the gravitational influence of the sun, but we are saying that we're in interstellar space, meaning that we're out of the charged particle bubble that surrounds our sun, what we call the heliosphere.
Now, eventually, though, with the Voyager going on, 40,000 years from now, the Voyager will, in fact, be out of the solar system, right?
It could take up to actually more than, well, at 40,000 years, yeah, we would be out of the solar system.
Okay, yeah,
that's a correct statement.
Right. I figured I was safe with that one. But and the main reason I raised that 40,000, we'll get into a little bit later, because that's actually the projection of some of where Voyager is headed toward in terms of time-wise and distance from where it started off. Now, you talked about it crossing into interstellar space. What exactly does that mean?
Well, what that means is that the effects of the solar wind, if you think of solar flares that come off the sun, they have hot charged particles, and the effect of that can no longer be felt by the Voyager spacecraft. We're so far away from the sun, 11.6 billion miles, that we've crossed what we call the heliopause, and we're into interstellar space, where the material that Voyager is sensing is material from other stars. It's not the material from our own sun.
Mm-hmm. And the significance of that?
Well, it's a first. You know, I think the significance, it's a brand new region. The whole Voyager mission launched back in 1977 and traveling past each of the outer gas planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, those were all discoveries. Voyager made many, many discoveries at each planetary flyby. And this mission continues to make discoveries. We've made discoveries when we crossed the termination shock in 2004, and we've made discoveries now going into interstellar space. We're the only spacecraft that is out in interstellar space, and they're physically sort of touching and sensing what's around it in interstellar space.
So in other words, we are in that sort of that Star Trek zone, right? A place where nothing human has ever been before.
Oh, that's correct.
Yeah,
this the little spacecraft that could is boldly gone where no spacecraft has gone before.
There you go. My assistant producer is cheering. He's a big Trekkie, and he's sitting back there cheering. Okay. We were tempted to open up with that quote from Captain Kirk, but we didn't do it. Okay. Let's pursue this a little bit more, because when you talk about the original mission of the Voyager, it's very interesting to me, because here in 1977, you had the original mission, which was very sort of, I guess on one level, there were probably people who were thinking expansively, but it was also there was an element of uncertainty in terms of exploration, which is very important in science, and we can talk about that in a minute. But it also had a very defined mission, right?
When the Voyager was launched in 1977, and I should say there's actually two Voyager spacecraft. They're identical, and they're both still operating. They're traveling away from us in slightly different directions, but they're both still operating. But in 1977, the original mission was to go by Jupiter and Saturn. However, we took advantage of having a unique planetary alignment, which only happens every 176 years, where you can reach all of the outer planets. You can go by all four of the outer planets in a 12-year time period. That's because they're all lined up basically on the same side of the sun. The last time that had happened was when Thomas Jefferson was president. So we took advantage of that alignment of the planets in 1977 in order to get our spacecraft initially to Jupiter and Saturn, and then we were allowed to continue with Voyager 2 to travel by Uranus and Neptune. And each time we go by one of those planets, we gain speed due to the gravity assist of the planet that we're going by. So the Voyager spacecraft actually get faster every time they went by a planet.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Suzanne Dodd, the project manager of Voyager, of the Voyager project. And we're talking about the Voyager having just basically began its journey into it is in interstellar space, and it's going to who the hell knows where, but it's going to be pretty exciting to follow it around. One of the things that I wanted to ask you, Suzanne, is how much did the role of accident play in actually being where we are now, where it's, 11 billion miles away from is it away from the Earth or away from the sun or whatever, but it's 11 billion miles away. And it's something that's almost incomprehensible. And was that built into the project? Was there we know we're eventually, it's just going to eventually fly off. It's going to be 11 billion miles away. Or was it more sort of, wow, this is interesting because it hasn't stopped functioning and it's headed towards the interstellar space. This is a trip. How much of that was actually planned and how much of it was accident?
I think it's fair to say that it's a combination of planning and good fortune. Certainly anytime you have a spacecraft last for 36 years, and two spacecraft in this case last for 36 years, that has a little bit of luck in it. It's like trying to keep your car running for many years. And then, so there is a role of luck. And secondly, though, I would say that the engineers and planners really built a robust spacecraft. They really had a vision where they wanted this spacecraft to make it as long as possible and possibly make it into interstellar space. So their primary focus was on the planetary flybys, but they did the little extra touches and the little extra checkouts to try to ensure that it could get us, it lasts as long as possible and travel out away from us for as long as possible.
Those sneaky engineers, always plotting and planning, I'll tell you. But here, tell me this, though. It's very, because when you're talking about that, I was thinking, all right, but there's certain limitations that are faced because of the fact that the spacecraft was launched in 1977. So we're talking, as you said, 36 years ago. And the technology that was available to us then was probably state of the art then, but is now somewhat of a limiting factor. And it kind of amazed me to see the way that you guys sort of jerry-rig things and figured out how to do things and when things would fail. Like, for instance, I read where the plasma sensors actually had stopped functioning in 1981. But yet you're still able to measure this point of plasma and where it's, you know, how you know you're in plasma when you're inside, you know, when you're in the interstellar space, which is made up of plasma. I think that's what's being said,
that's
right?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah. So this question of the technology, the level of technology, which was state-of-the-art then, now is, you know, like, well, let's face it, an 8-track tape recorder sending back data, you know, it's kind of, it tells people, gives people a sense of like the limitations, but then how much has been achieved, both with just that simple technology, but also with the ingenuity of you guys working on this. So can we talk about that a little?
Sure. Well, it was launched in 1977, so the technology is mid-70s. And you know, you mentioned the 8-track tape recorder, which is still functioning and actually played a key role in determining whether we were in interstellar space or not, because the data was recorded on the tape recorder and then played back later. So it played a key role in this historic event. You know, another example we like to use is the Voyager spacecraft had 68 kilobytes of memory on board. Now your smartphone has about 240,000 times more memory. So just what everybody walks around with in their pocket today is over 200,000 times more memory than the Voyager spacecraft. So, you know, we have to, it's basically a simple spacecraft. And in some ways, I think that may have made it last so long. It's not as complicated as a spacecraft you would build today. So I like to use the analogy with a car. Some, you know, classic cars, the engines, you could open up the hood and understand what was going on, and nowadays you can't. So it's a little bit similar with Voyager in that, you know, the technology was state of the art for 1975. Don't get me wrong, but today would be considered simplistic, and I think some of that simplicity allows the spacecraft to continue on without as much problems.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Suzanne Dodd, the Voyager project manager, and we're talking about all the questions that have come up around the Voyager actually reaching interstellar space, the first time anything from this planet has gotten that far, and all that we're learning from it and will learn, and we'll get into some of the stuff what we will learn. You know, Suzanne, one of the things I wanted to ask you, too, though, was, you know, the question of, I was really sort of possessed by this, the scientific spirit involved in all this, because when you came up, I read one story where you were talking about the 8-track tape recorder has limited space in terms of what it's able to, you know, the memory it has or the storage space it has, and you were confronted with something. Here you're about to go into this like just world historic, you know, spot in terms of what's going on, and you have to figure out, okay, how do we actually get more space on this thing? And you had to go out and solve that rather than throw your hands up and say there's nothing we can do about it. Can you tell people how you solved that?
Sure. A couple of years ago, when we started seeing a lot of changes in the environment the spacecraft was in as we were getting closer to the heliopause, so the scientists came to us, the engineers here at JPL, and asked if they could get some additional recorded data on the tape recorder. Well, the tape recorder is, again, we talked about how small the memory is on the spacecraft. So to make any kind of changes to what's already planned on board really requires a strategy and a knowledge of a system, an in-depth knowledge of the system. So, but like, you know, like any good set of engineers, you want to tackle the problem. And so we have a gentleman that's actually worked on this project since 1975, in particular in the area of tape recorder management and our instrument command system, who was able to design a strategy to add the extra record without taking any more of the memory space, because there really isn't any more memory space available. We have no free space because it's so small. Now, he works on the project, and he's been on the project since 1975. You can imagine that he's not the youngest engineer, but, you know, he's very dedicated to the project and very motivated to see this mission continue and to help it, you know, continue having great discoveries.
Plus, he was probably the only guy whose car in the parking lot had an 8-track player on it, right?
Yeah, I like to say he's the only person in the world that can program 8-track tape recorder on a spacecraft, and now one that's in interstellar space.
So. Right. That's what a trip. What a cool.
What cool.
Yeah, very cool. What imagine going back to your kids and saying, "Yeah, you know what I do."
Exactly.
There you go. Well, let's talk about this other piece of actually really interesting thing that's included in the spacecraft, which is the Golden Record. I was really tripped out about that. Let's talk about that a little.
Well, each of the Voyager spacecraft contains a Golden Record. It was designed by Carl Sagan and a team that he put together. And the idea was to capture Earth and humanity and put it on, in a time capsule, basically, and send it off with a Voyager spacecraft. Now, what's on that record is music and greetings and animal sounds and images, and they come from all over the Earth, not just from the United States, but they cover all different parts of the world. It's a time capsule of us and a piece of humanity that we've now sent into interstellar space. It's now traveling in between stars, and that's where the Voyager spacecraft is, and that's where this little piece of us is also. So we can all say that we're traveling in between the stars now.
Plus, I understand there's a direction, a sort of MapQuest direction set in there. Here's where Earth is. Come and visit.
Yeah, there is some directions on how to play it, for example, because it is an LP. It looks like something that you had in your bedroom with a phonograph that you would play when you were playing, Bee Gees songs or something like that. It is an LP, so there's directions on how to play the LP as well as directions or diagrams on where it came from as far as coming from the planet Earth.
Yeah, I mean, that was one thing that did trip me up because it concentrates kind of that outlook of endless possibilities in the universe. It was just sort of, who knows what's out there? We certainly don't.
I think it speaks to the extraordinary vision that the creators of the Voyager spacecraft had. Not only did they want to build a spacecraft that would last long enough to get into interstellar space, they also wanted all of us to travel on it with it. And mm-hmm. that Ghost Gold Records has really connected the Voyager mission with everyone here on the Earth. Everybody's excited to think about what it's like to be in interstellar space. And, through this Gold Record, we've been able to touch all of humanity, not just the scientific community.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Suzanne Dodd, the Voyager project manager, and we're talking about all the questions that have come up around the Voyager actually reaching interstellar space, the first time anything from this planet has gotten that far. Well, I have two more questions for you. One is, you've already touched on a little bit, but I wanted to explore a little bit more. What are some of the most significant things in your mind that the Voyager has done so far?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, every time Voyager went by a planet, it discovered something new. Volcanoes on Io, the ring systems around Saturn. Voyager 2 is the only spacecraft that's gone by Uranus and Neptune, and we knew nothing about those planets. They were just kind of little fuzzy dots from a ground-based telescope until Voyager went by, and we could see, the great storms on Neptune, and we could see the ring system at Uranus, things that we had never seen before. And Voyager continues that journey now into interstellar space. It's certainly giving us more new discoveries, but giving us more questions. And I think that's one of the things that's great about the Voyager missions. We answer questions, but we also raise more questions. Everything that Voyager has seen through its 36 years of travels is not necessarily what we expected. We answer some questions, but we create more questions as we go on this voyage of discovery.
Isn't that great? That's really tremendous. I really like that. And that leads in right into my last question, which is what lies ahead, both the immediate future, but also 40,000 years down the line?
Well, we have many more years of operating ahead of us. We use a radioisotope thermoelectric generator for our power source. So it's basically radioactive decay that generates heat that we turn into electricity to operate Voyager. And we can continue with all the current instruments until 2020. So we have 7 more years of taking data with the instruments that basically have told us we're in interstellar space. And then from 2020 to 2025, we will have to start turning off one instrument at a time. And by 2025, we will likely have to have all the instruments off. But we could still return an engineering signal, basically a hello from the spacecraft. We still could return that out until 2035 or 36. But power is the big resource that we have to manage, and it's decreasing at about 4 watts a year. So that's, but that gives us, a good 13 more years to get back science data and to discover what's ahead of the Voyager spacecraft in interstellar space.
And what's ahead of for humanity, and really, thank you very much for actually striking a very strong blow in favor of materialism and science in the world. Okay, thank you. And for revealing so much of the beauty of what's out there, just that we can understand and need to understand. So, Suzanne, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Suzanne Dodd, Voyager Project Manager, about the Voyager spacecraft, Voyager 1, that has just crossed over into interstellar space, the furthest thing ever from a human thing ever from Earth, and furthest away than anything else from Earth, and the first time that anything from Earth has actually gone out there in that direction, and will be going on for at least 40,000 more years. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Sikivu Hutchinson to talk about her book, Godless Americana, Race and Religious Rebels. So stay tuned. God is a concept by which we measure our pain. All right, welcome back. John Lennon with God. John Lennon and the Plastic Ono Band with God. All right, joining us now is Sikivu Hutchinson, author of Godless Americana, Race and Religious Rebels. She's also the author of Moral Combat, which I had read before, and we had her on the show to talk about before, a fascinating book. And this book is a collection of essays that challenge the myths behind Americana images of mom, apple pie, white picket fences, and racially segregated, God-fearing Main Street USA. And it does this, it probes deeply into the roles of faith and radical humanist politics in an era of racial, sexual, and religious warfare. Sikivu, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. And you doing good?
Doing well. I like the intro with John and Yoko.
Yeah, it's a great song. It's one that's never played enough. Okay, it's really, it's just amazing. Well, let's jump into this. Tell people what your book's about and what compelled you to write it.
Well, I was compelled to write it by the extreme atmosphere of right-wing reactionary backlash that has intensified in the nation since the 2010 midterm elections. And as an African-American feminist, humanist, and atheist, I thought it was imperative to follow up Moral Combat, Black Atheist, Gender Politics, and the Values Wars with a resounding denunciation of this atmosphere that is really a backlash against the deep and abiding civil, human, and social justice rights that people of color and disenfranchised folk have forged in this nation. And we have seen so much Christian fascist savaging of women's rights, of abortion rights, of reproductive justice, of LGBT communities, families, partners, and children, of public education, the neoliberal gutting of public education, the degree to which that is totally foreclosed, culturally responsive teaching, pedagogy, and leadership development, as well as, obviously, the gutting of the Voting Rights Act and the increase in hysterical attacks against undocumented immigrants, families, and communities. So I bring together all of these strands in Godless Americana to really provide a robust argument for and defense of radical, culturally relevant humanism. That is not something that is certainly within the mainstream discourse of traditional new atheist ideology and language and messaging. And this was something that I felt was vitally needed because there is a slight increase in the numbers of folk of color that are openly identified as non-believers, as humanists, as agnostics, as free thinkers. And we have a very robust tradition of African-American secular humanist intellectualism and radical progressive thought. I mean, certainly forged by major thinkers and intellectuals like A. Philip Randolph and Frederick Douglass and Richard Wright and Langston Hughes and Hubert Henry Harrison and Zora Neale Hurston. And these are voices and traditions that are simply not present within mainstream new atheist parlance, discourse, and organizing.
Well, let's explore that a little more, because you take on in the book, and when you've talked about it, you've taken on the idea that that what you say actually exists in a large part of this new atheist movement. The rest of this is that all one needs to do is take up a materialist scientific view and everything else will fall into place in terms of these other points that you're mentioning, these other facts that you're mentioning, and that essentially issues of oppression due to gender and or skin color can be taken care of simply through adopting a scientific view.
Yeah, I mean, I find that to be extremely arrogant, wrong-headed, paternalistic, and white supremacist. And so I make a number of connections in the book, you know, between this brand of thinking and the whole trajectory of the racialization of black bodies and bodies of color, you know, within scientific discourse and scientific enterprise tied to the Enlightenment tradition, and the degree to which our whole history as African descent peoples in the United States has been in response to, in radical resistance and rebellion to, this whole notion that somehow or other we have been constructed as the antipodes of civilization, of whiteness, of humanity, of the whole notion of democratic purchase, that these are things that are not traditionally deconstructed within new atheist discourse, because there's such an investment in the whole narrative of Western exceptionalism and Western Enlightenment principles without looking at the degree to which white supremacy and the radical dehumanization of African peoples was deeply embedded within Enlightenment ideology, ethos, and discourse.
You know, yeah, and actually you take this on in a very interesting way, too, because you actually point, you know, you go through, you don't just say that, but you actually go through some of the people who generally, I mean, like someone like Susan Jacoby, who generally would be considered among, you know, those that you'd want to unite with in a certain sense in terms of what they're doing to go up against all the, you know, the Christian fascism and the idealism, the spirituality in the world. And also, you know, these, you know, a number of other places where you actually point out that, look, these people, a lot of people are actually, they're taking this up, but they're actually ignoring this very, very fundamental fact about this society. And that, and I'd like to talk about that a little bit, because I was also very deeply appreciative of your comments about Jefferson, which so many, you know, you hear that so often. Thomas Jefferson, the great humanitarian, Thomas Jefferson, the great. And yeah, there's people recognize some things about him, but actually still upholds this thing about his role in society, his role in democracy. And then when you read the sort of the arrogant, you know, racist oppression, racism that's existing in what he says, and then also Susan Jacoby, who falls into a thing of just ignoring, more or less ignoring the whole. Even when she points to people who've been involved in this, especially among women, free thinkers and whatnot, she avoids the fact that there were a lot of contradictions in there too.
Yes, and I take that apart in the chapter called "Prayer Warriors and Free Thinkers," and you know, look at the historic ambivalence that women of color have had towards traditions of secularism and free thought, and the degree to which this ambivalence was really situated in the power, privilege, and authority that European-American first-wave feminists exercised within the abolitionist movement and the early women's movement, and the degree to which forerunning free thinkers like Elizabeth Cady Stanton were deeply nativist, deeply white supremacist, deeply colonialist, and yes, steeped within the abolitionist tradition, you know, very supportive of advancing emancipation, you know, for African peoples, but simultaneously very invested in this notion of the cult of true womanhood. The fact, in their mind, that white women were really the paradigms, you know, the shining paragons of civilization. And this is something that was a big dynamic in the battle over the 15th Amendment to confer men of color with the right to vote. This was an argument that was, you know, consistently articulated by white feminist freethinkers like Stanton, to basically circumvent the 15th Amendment, to say that men of color, specifically African-American men, should not gain the right to vote over and above white civilized women. And this is something that has been incredibly formative for 21st century women's movement organizing. And the fact that there has always been this deep schism between the realities, the cultural context, the political dynamics that have shaped the lives of African-American, Latino, Indigenous, and Asian women versus that of privileged white women that are very steeped within a white supremacist notion of what is a rightful feminist issue.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sikivu Hutchinson, author of Godless Americana, Race and Religious Rebels. Sikivu, tell me this. You know, one of the things I wanted to explore with you as well is you spend a lot of time and effort and do some very good work in relation to exposing the role of the white Christian nationalism, white Christian fascism, basically, in general in society, and in particular in relation to the oppression of Black and Latino people. And you explore that, and I'd like to talk a little bit about that, and then I have a second question related to that, which I'll get into after you talk on that.
Well, I wanted to look at this in terms of the impact that Christian fascism has had on the economy and on issues of education, of mass incarceration, reproductive justice, and quote-unquote LGBT enfranchisement. And the way in which there has been, again, you know, this wholesale gutting and undermining and demonization of social justice, and it has been done on the right of the Christian fascist Tea Party white nationalist agenda, disguised as the populist white agenda. And I thought it was very important to try and tease out the class dimensions of that, you know, really go back to the work that was done by scholars like Theodore Allen and Winthrop Jordan and Carter G. Woodson on this question of whiteness and class power and how we've really seen that, you know, come to the fore most fascistically in the Tea Party narrative, you know, of taking back the country and taking back the country being a moral charge, a moral vision, you know, really springing from this notion that, you know, white people are so intractably disenfranchised and oppressed, given the fact that there is an African-American president, which is totally contradictory, you know, because of his neoliberal, extremely imperialist agenda. But that aside, this whole facade that there has been, you know, this wholesale dismantling of white purchase on the American dream, and that somehow or other the socioeconomic deficits of capitalism have, you know, most oppressed and disenfranchised white working class people.
One of the things I wanted to ask you in relation to this too, though, is that you know, and this will be the last question because we're running up on our time, but I wanted to get into this a little bit because I think it's a very important part of the book overall and of what you've been talking about. You know, you've talked about this sort of, and you spoke about this a little bit, about the impetus for writing the book, but there's also the fact that there's a general growth, there's somewhat of a growth in terms of people being nons, I guess you call them, the people who have no religious or spiritual beliefs in society, but that the situation is very different when you're talking about the situation among people of oppressed nationalities, Black and Latino people in particular, and that basically you argue that secularism and atheism will only take root among oppressed nationalities, women and other historically oppressed people, if it addresses structural and systemic causes behind the suffering people face. And I think that's extremely important. And I notice in the way you actually weave in your work with students in the high schools, which is really incredibly important. And I think, and was very, you know, I learned a lot through listening to, you know, what the students were saying, how they were posing things, and how they looked at their participation in the world. Can you talk about that in terms of the, you know, how this secularism and atheism, which is important, not the only thing, but is important, and how it will only take root among oppressed nationalities and women and other historically oppressed people if it addresses structural and systemic causes?
Well, if we look at our communities, for example, and the way in which faith-based institutions have become a kind of a cultural and social bedrock within our communities, the extent to which we drive down the street in Inglewood in South Los Angeles, Manchester, you know, from Crenshaw to Van Ness, and we see storefront after storefront, which is either vacant, which is inhabited by a 99-cent store, a nail shop, a liquor store, or a storefront church. We do not have, for the most part, deeply embedded and supported culturally responsive institutions in our communities. They've been utterly deracinated. And that is why so many people of color are still deeply invested in faith-based institutions and churches, because in many regards, these institutions are still providing the kind of social welfare resources and avenues that have vanished, you know, within our communities as a result of the ongoing depression that we're steeped in. And so when we talk about young people of color who may not be deeply involved in organized religion, you know, but still, you know, have some sense of spirituality, some sense of obeisance to a supernatural being or deities, that is also a part of it, because they see the institutions in their communities that are stepping up, that may be involved in provision of social welfare, that may be involved in social justice, advocacy, and activism, being in large regard faith-based institutions and other nonprofits, of course. But this is the quandary that we have as radical progressive, secular humanists of color, that we must begin to build institutions that redress systemic, racial, heterosexist, sexist, white supremacist, and class-based inequities. Otherwise, there will be no purchase within a movement of humanism.
All right, Sakivu, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And your book is available widely on Amazon, right? And other places, other stores?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sakivu. Look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks.
Take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Sakivu Hutchinson, author of Godless Americana, Race and Religious Rebels. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with the two of the actors from this new play, What Kind of God? Okay, that's a big question for everyone. What kind of God? Okay, so stay tuned. Be No Catholic Boy by the Dead Boys, all right? That's right, and you've heard me say this many times before. 16 years of torture in Catholic schools has made me sing that song every morning when I get up out of bed. Although I've moved on to much better things to be, okay, as you know. Communist revolutionary, there you go. So, joining us now, I was inspired to play that song yet again because I saw a play last week that really kind of knocked me back in my seat. And the play was called What Kind of God? It's written by Steve Julian, who is a playwright and does some kind of show on KPCC in Los Angeles, too. And Steve's going to be joining us, as well as two of the actors from the play, Robert Kiesler and Catherine McGee. There you go. Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Okay, you guys are going to have to talk right into the mics because this isn't like being on stage. Okay?
Yeah, good morning.
Okay. And do it like this. Okay. There you go. So why don't we, let me bring Steve. Welcome to the show.
Michael, thank you very much. How are you?
I'm good. Let's have you start. Tell people what the play is about.
Well, first of all, let me say that you mentioned KPCC, and I appreciate that. And this play, of course, has nothing all to do with my work over there. It's just, you know, my own separate thing. I was a theater major. This story is about the consequences of giving the wrong people too much power and what happens when we try to silence those who have something to say. And in this case, we said it in the Catholic Church.
Let me, I've read a number of places where it's talked about as the cost of silence, because I'll get into that thing about also I've seen it's the chasm between belief and trust. But I wanted to talk a little bit about this, the cost of silence, because that is something that just really just sits very heavily on the audience and on the play, and not in a bad way. I mean, it's just something that's really, wow, this is, you really get the sense of that, the terrible price paid through silence. And maybe I can ask one of the actors here, or both of the actors. Rachel, how about you first? Rachel, I called you Rachel, your character. See, you did it.
My character's name is Rachel, and definitely I love how you put it, the cost of silence, because in this particular show, we all remain silent about something, and the cost in some instances is quite heavy, not just for ourselves, but for those around us who we interact with in the play. Robert,
I think that you hit it on the nose. It's when we choose to keep silent about who we are or our particular story, that has consequences that ripple through the lives of everyone we come in contact with.
Which brings me back to you, Steve. You know, this point about you had your own experience with going to Catholic high school, and your own experience with being silenced yourself. But in this play in particular, the point of it's not just the silence. It's actually there's something that happens there that just permeates the whole thing. And I was really blown away. You know, you get a situation where we could talk about the chasm between belief and trust, but it was very heavy to me, you know, this idea of here you have almost every character in the play has some, they're silent in some way about something. And it has such a terrible, it's a terrible weight. And each one is carrying it around and they're finding each other, but never able to break through. And it was, well, let's talk about that.
Well, there are always repercussions when we keep secrets from our loved ones and when we are too fearful to speak out about our own needs and curiosities and beliefs. And when we have pressure from people around us to be quiet, a lot of that can fester and go into emotional directions that are so unhealthy that they can be really physically dangerous and, of course, emotionally harmful as well. I think all five people in this play experience that, just like most people I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, except the one thing here too, though, is that you have there's the power of authority that also is very, I mean, it's very big in this. I think it's a very big question here. It's not just people sort of deciding that they're going to keep selling, but there's this whole the weight of authority and the way things are, and you can't really pierce through that cloud. It's a very heavy thing. I mean, I think I should tell people you also play one of the characters in the play, and. And one of the more heinous characters in the play, too, which, thank you very much, the bishop. And, you know, it's sort of, I remember, you know, and this is a short story, and I'll stop right at this, because, you know, when I was a kid and I got confirmation, you know, and it was, we were told that there was one question we couldn't ask, and that was, we couldn't ask the archbishop, we couldn't ask him about the Trinity. And I'm like, oh, come on, I'm 8 years old, you know, and so it just stuck in my head. And it was like that thing you just got to get out. And so, of course, I raised my hand and I said, how can you have three in one? Right. And boy, the nuns flew out of the pews. They beat the hell out of me. I got up on the altar, and the bishop, when he gave me that slap, actually slapped me like crazy. Right. And it was okay. But this is on what you're talking about and what your play gets into. It's a much heavier scene where you have the voice of authority and, you know, really hundreds and hundreds of years of moral authority to deep to dedicated Catholics. It's telling you that no, nothing. You can't say anything. Let's talk about that a little, and then you can think about it a minute. Let me go to Rachel and Robert and talk about this. I was about to call you Father Bart. Okay. So there you go. That's how deep you guys got into me. So which one of you wants to start?
I actually have a similar story, because I was raised in Presbyterian school and in the South, and we were just taught not to ask questions. When I asked my Bible teacher in high school, why would God kill these people in these stories in such heinous ways? And oh man, he got so angry, just screaming at me in front of the other students, "How dare you question God's ways, God's authority?" It was so embarrassing. And I think that is evident throughout the play, is that how dare you question authority? How dare you question God's will? We don't even actually know for sure what God intends for us. And I think that is also in the play, especially with Father Bart, Robert, that scene you have when you're talking about you don't actually know what we don't actually know what God intends for us or what he thinks of us.
Well, and the idea of judgment, you know, judging exactly. others, judging and trying to put ourselves in God's place and judge his intention. We have a very similar background, Catherine and I. I mean, I grew up in the South too and went to Catholic school and got sent to the principal's office one day for asking too many questions. It was just, you know, it's like the inquisitive mind and no, you can't have that.
Right. But what's amazing is that if you don't ask those questions and you're not allowed to ask those questions and you remain silent, it really grows as a sickness within you. And, you know, in our own real lives, I mean, that sickness can manifest itself into actual illnesses. And in the play, it's unbelievable. For me personally, being on stage working through this character of Rachel, how it is nauseous for most of the show.
Let me remind listeners, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Steve Julien, the playwright, and actors Robert Kessler and Catherine McGee. And we're talking about the play, What Kind of God? And that actually does raise the question you raised. What kind of God actually does allow? Because we're not talking about asking questions that can't be answered, but questions that need to be spoken to. And especially in the case of where it involves things that are really, really both horribly oppressive and really, really harmful. Steve, how about you chiming in on this?
Well, one thing that I've tried to do in writing the play and these characters is to switch up the reactions that you might think you would find in society. So that the bishop is a bit of a hypocrite, as Robert and Catherine can attest. And the teenage boy, Aaron, is the one who really fights on behalf of the church. He thinks he wants to be a priest. He thinks that his faith is that strong, that there are some internal conflicts and doubts that he has, and questions that he's afraid to address. He finally does feel the ability to address him with Father Bart because of their longstanding confidence with each other. And we're lucky when that can happen. But boy, I'll tell you that there can be repercussions when there is a situation or a person who will shut you down. Michael does this, Bishop Michael does this too, with Bart. There's a rather lengthy scene in the play where Michael really tells Bart, "You are going to tell me what I want to know, whether you like it or not." And maybe Robert can chime in on what that feels like.
Yeah, that would be interesting, actually.
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the... Interestingly enough, it's one of the, for me, more difficult and more powerful scenes in the play. It's several minutes of constant... how do I put it?
Badgering?
Well, that, but I mean, also kind of being constantly in the hot seat. It is in its own way, it's an interrogation, I can only imagine what a real interrogation would feel like. But this is it has a lot of those same components. There's a lot of manipulation. There's a lot of sort of underhandedness and a lot of, quick for, Bishop Montgomery, quick thinking on his feet to twist my words and and use them against me in the moment. So, yeah, that's.
But there's, at the same time, it's one of the things that really got to me is that as I'm sitting there watching it and you're looking at like your relationship with the young man is, and as well as yours, you know, it's Catherine, you have a more familiar relationship with the young man and a loving familial relationship. And you have a relationship that's like sort of a mentor mentee, but more than that, because there's from the very beginning, there's the familiarity, the touch that goes back and forth, just the familiarity with each other, you know. And yet at the same time, I kept sitting through the play. this play really mirrored a lot of the society itself, the society we live in, and in both the arrogance of the people who have done heinous things, the sense of entitlement, and the fact, mainly, the fact that the most intimate, beautiful relationships that humans can have been turned into these very warped, oppressive relations. And the consequences of that, that's an extremely heavy thing going on the stage. And I think that's actually one of the things that keeps everybody on the edge of their seat in it.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the beautiful things about the play. It's certainly one of the most uncomfortable things about the play. I mean, let's face it, you say Catholic priest and everyone immediately jumps to some conclusions, whether, you know, those are founded or not. So, you know, taking on that role and trying to find that balance, especially in Bart's relationship with Aaron, of, you know, what is loving, what is nurturing, what is protective, and how do we portray that in such a way that draws the audience in and lets them come to their own conclusions. And, you know, hopefully if we do our job, at the end of the day, they realize they made some judgments pretty quickly that are incorrect. And so they walk away, hopefully, I think, going, oh, well, did I judge too quickly?
Let me remind listeners, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Steve Julien, the playwright, and actors Robert Kessler and Catherine McGee, and we're talking about the play, What Kind of God? I have to tell you, part of the beauty of the play and the strength of the play and the writing of the play is that, you know, even your character, who's one of the most likable characters in the play, at the same time, there's just this creepy edge that reflects this kind of... No, I mean, serious. There's a creepy edge that reflects what I was just talking about, how it mirrors back this society. No matter how much you try not to, it's there. And boy, is that a heavy... That's a heavy sense to have.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, on that note, I mean, it's one of those things that I have found so shocking. And it's not just in the church. It's in schools. It's everywhere. How what used to be considered, when I was growing up, normal human relations have been in their own way perverted so that now we look at any kind of kindness or care with a certain amount of suspicion.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Catherine, you'll have one chance to say something and then we'll give Steve the last word because we're running up on our time. So go ahead.
No, I just want to say Rachel, my character, acts as a kind of parent figure to Aaron, the young boy, and that in and of itself comes with some heavy, hard, full of heart issues for when it finally does come out what I've been keeping from him and why it's so difficult.
Mm-hmm. Steve, what about you? You want to chime in there?
Well, it's fun for me to step completely away from the public radio model and to delve into fiction that is based in part in some truth and in some stories that have actually happened. We try to represent thousands and thousands of stories that have not been told just by these five characters, and it's what we aim to do. Our aim also is to really inspire a conversation about what's going on, whether it's inside the church or in sports or in police departments or in the military, wherever there's a power structure where people are pushed down and silenced, and we have to really look at why we do that and how we can get away from doing that.
And again, I'd pose for all three of you, what kind of God, huh?
I know. What kind of God? Absolutely.
We've all asked that question at one point or another.
All right.
Well, I'm thankful to be here right now. I'll tell you that.
Yes.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, you can come back anytime you want, Steve.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay. All right, Steve. Thank you very much. Robert, Catherine, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank
all right,
you.
And again, the play is What Kind of God? I'm going to go out now with something that I wanted to read from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, that has everything to do with what we were talking about throughout the show, which is knowing about actual reality and continually learning more about it is vitally important for humanity and its future. It's vitally important not only for people in the sciences and the academic world, but for the brutally oppressed and exploited people of the earth who must and can be the backbone and driving force of a revolution to throw off and put an end to all forms of exploitation and oppression throughout the globe, to be the emancipators not only of themselves, but ultimately of all humanity, confronting reality as it actually is and as it is changing and developing, and understanding the underlying and driving forces in this is crucial in order to play a decisive and leading role in bringing about this revolution and ushering in a whole new era of human history, which will shatter and remove forever Not only the material chains, the economic, social, and political shackles of exploitation and oppression that enslave people in today's world, but also the mental chains, the ways of thinking and the culture that correspond to and reinforce those material chains. In the Communist Manifesto, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, who founded the communist movement over 150 years ago, declared that the communist revolution and its emancipating principles, methods, and aims involves a radical rupture, not only with the traditional property relations that enslave people in one form or another, but also a radical rupture with all traditional ideas that reflect and reinforce the traditional property relations. So with that, I want everybody to think about that, and we'll talk about it again next week. Write to me, and you can tell me what you think about that, and you can find it in the book Basics by Bob Avakian. I want to thank my assistant producer today, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer, Teddy Robinson, all of my guests today, and all of you for tuning in. You want to write to me, you can, at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me, you can through Twitter and Facebook. And last but not least, by any means, I want to repeat again, if you have any desire at all to want to contribute to the show in any kind of way, there's lots of stuff that people can do, transcribing interviews, helping to find guests, suggesting different subjects to take on, spreading the word about the show, anything you want to do, write to me at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. Write to me and we'll get things going, all right? We're going to go out now with a song that sort of captures the spirit of the whole show, but also is really kind of dedicated to the Voyager project, the Voyager 1 especially, as it heads off into deep interstellar space, aiming for 43,000 years away and billions of miles, all right, many billions of miles to go. And this is David Bowie with Space Oddity. Talk to you again next week.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
8, 7.
Commencing countdown, engines on.
3, 2.
Check ignition,
1.
And may God's love lift be off with you. This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade, and the papers want to know whose shirt you wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule if you dare. This is Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping through the door. Stars look very different today. For here am I sitting in a tin can. For